Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
I said, empty your mind. Be formless, shapeless, like water. Now you put water into a cup, it becomes the cup. You put water into a bottle, it becomes the bottle. You put it in a teapot, it becomes the teapot. Now water can flow or it can crash. Be water, my friend.
Hey everybody, this is Brett and welcome back to School Sucks. Today is February 16th. What a busy month, huh? Out there in the world. People like to pack a lot of stuff into this teeny little month, don't they? I mean, we've got Valentine's Day. We've got President's Birthdays to celebrate. We've got the entire history of African Americans. That's no small undertaking. Trust me, I used to be a history teacher. And of course, these presidential primaries. Have you been following all of this? Good heavens. We're going to need to assemble the podcast masters to deal with that mess pretty soon. Details to come. So today, the third installment in the February theme, The Principles of Learning Anything, Steve Patterson and I continue our conversation with the principle of efficiency. Now, I've been working on a little mind map on my new dry erase surface that is right above my desk that I might share with you by the end of the month. But what I wish to make clear in this short little monologue here is that these first three principles that we're talking about are all very, very interconnected. Well, we talked about technique in the first show. We're talking about efficiency today, and we're talking about mastery of the basics in the third show. So let's make some connections here. Even though we haven't talked about mastering the basics yet, I think this is maybe where a lot of you who heard our shows on classical education or the trivium, you would think of this as the starting point. The fundamentals, the very, very specific pieces of what in any pursuit. And when those basics or those fundamentals are assembled, integrated, and understood, they contribute to efficiency, the most effective ways for putting the what's together. And from there, we get a more comprehensive how, which is technique, the method through which what you've learned is basically expressed. So to a lot of you, that might sound very familiar. I really liked Steve's approach. I thought this was a fresh and interesting way of talking about the subject of learning, and I hope you're on board with that as well. I would love to get some input from people in the audience. Questions for Steve would be terrific. I'm sure he would be happy to answer them. We were actually supposed to record today, but he got called in for jury duty. Now, I think it's just a one-day thing. Hopefully, this isn't going to be like an O.J. Simpson ordeal where he's going to be sequestered for months and he's going to have to watch people try on gloves. And I think we're actually going to be able to pick things up tomorrow, and that's when we're going to be recording our discussion about the third principle. So get those questions in. The School Sucks Project Facebook group is a great place to go and do that. You can also comment on the episodes as they're posted to schoolsucksproject.com. To get your feedback and incorporate it into the show, I'm even willing to brave the YouTube comment section. That's where the craziest people in the world go to share their little thoughts on the internet, but I'm willing to venture there to see what you have to say. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and please subscribe to Steve's YouTube channel. His username is Steve Fought. Thank you to each and every one of you for taking time out of your ridiculously busy month of February to listen to School Sucks, especially if you live in the Northeast, because you also have snow shoveling to do. We got a few inches last night, if you know what I mean, and the top of it, like, turned to ice. So my car was in, like, a cocoon this morning, like an ice cocoon that I had to break through with a shovel. It was neat. welcome back.
Great to be with you.
In the previous discussion, we talked about the principle of technique as kind of an overarching concept that the other four fit into. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
In the next two shows, we're going to talk about two that are closely related, the first one being the principle of efficiency. And before we get started, can I just get a definition?
Yes. So the principle of efficiency is getting from A to B with the least amount of energy required, or getting from A to B while eliminating all unnecessary steps in the process.
Mm-hmm. So
I can give some examples if you
want. Yeah, absolutely.
So martial arts is the one that I keep coming back to. You can think of the principle of efficiency in a couple of ways. One would be the actual motion from A to B. So in other words, if I have my arm here and I need my arm here, or I'm trying to get your arm here and remove it here, if I'm going to get it in a joint lock, it's not doing that in an inefficient way, in a roundabout way. It's being very linear. Move from here to here. Don't do some crazy circles in the process. Go from A to B quickly. Something like in chess, efficiency would be being able to accomplish what you're trying to accomplish on a chessboard in the least amount of moves. So, or it would be in chess, another great example would be in chess calculation. You have to be able, if you're going to be a good chess player, you have to know when to invest a lot of mental effort into calculating and when not to invest the mental effort. So if you're calculating a line that's guaranteed to lose, you're not calculating efficiency and you're gonna waste your energy. And that's not the correct way to play chess.
Can we talk a little bit more about that one? Maybe the actual operation of a skilled chess player, right? So basically the idea is you're outplayed in chess because somebody can do in two moves what you can only do in five.
Right.
How do you realize that as a slowly improving chess player when you're in that situation? What does it look like to realize you're being outplayed by somebody else because they're more efficient?
Well, and that evaluation would probably take place after the fact when you're reviewing the chess game. Maybe it's something you could discover while you're playing. But with chess in particular, where you get good at chess is not in the middle of games. It's the practice. It's the evaluating your games and going back over and looking at all the different errors that you made, errors that your opponent made. So rarely is there a huge amount of progress that's made while you're actually in the process of playing it. But what it would look like, for example, so if you understand the themes of chess and you understand this dynamic of what happens in the central part of the board versus what happens on the wings of the board. There's a lot of really interesting dynamics about how pawn structure affects the flow of the game versus the actual pieces like the knights and the bishops that you move. And you'll be able to see it pretty clearly. So if there's a theme, for example, on one side of the board, there's a lot of tension and there's a lot of action going on and the pieces are doing a lot, and your opponent has four or five pieces on that side of the board, and you only have two or three, and the other pieces are kind of stuck in a clunky position on the opposite side of the board, then you're going to be like, okay, well, obviously he was able to achieve his goal in a more efficient way than I was. And this is true both for offense and defense. So you want to be able to, if when you're attacking on a chessboard, you're trying to put up a lot of pressure on the king or on one piece, if your opponent knows it's coming and you can't do it very efficiently, he's going to be able to defend just fine. But if you can do it where you build up the pressure and then you attack, and it's what's called like a double attack, where you attack two things at once, and now your opponent is going to be overloaded and you're going to be able to execute your attack. The same is true as in defense. If you know an attack is coming, but you can't defend in time, you're inefficiently moving your pieces on the board, or your pieces are inefficiently placed on the board so that you literally can't move them efficiently, then you're not going to be able to defend yourself from an attack.
Do you see any parallels with something like debate?
Yeah, so in debate, for example, it's manyfold with debate, because debate is kind of a conceptual phenomenon. So on the one side, just understanding what you're talking about is necessary to be able to communicate it efficiently. If you don't really understand what you're talking about, and what comes out is kind of this disparate set of ideas that are kind of all over the place, number one, you're not going to be persuading anybody. And two, it's probably reflective that you don't actually understand what you're talking about. You see it all the time. And the same is true in reverse. When people are trying to be persuasive, not just in debate, but even just effective communication, they need to be efficient, right? If somebody is talking your ear off about minutiae and they skip over the important stuff, they're not going to be communicating effectively.
Let's focus in on debate. right? Okay. And let's say we're trying to become better at debating. And I've had discussions like this with people where I was clearly outmatched because I was wasting time or getting dragged into minutiae and not really articulating the key principles that were going to help me convince the other person. So let's relate technique to efficiency. When you're approaching something like a debate, what are the nuts and bolts considerations that go into something like that? And how do they work to essentially make you function in the actual situation better?
Right. So there are a lot of, just intuitively, I mean, it's not something I've thought a lot about, but there would be an intuitive set of core concepts or core things that you have to have under your belt if you're going to be a good debater. One is, like I said, knowledge of what you're talking about. The other is some knowledge of what your opponent is talking about. If you're totally unfamiliar with what he's talking about, then that's not a good technique of learning how to debate. You need to know not only what the person's going to say, but perhaps even know their ideas better than they do. That's a very effective way of debate. Another is the actual the method for articulation would be something that if you don't have that, if that piece of the puzzle's bad and you can't effectively communicate on your feet, then you're not going to be able to persuade anybody. This is something that I'm working on too, is sometimes I have a tendency to stop midway in my sentences because I like to be very precise. So I like to choose the perfect word. But sometimes that comes at the expense of hanging in the middle of the sentence, which is not a very good thing to listen to. It's not a very pleasant thing. Right. Right? I think I just did it when I like, it's just a habit. Some people who are masterful public speakers and articulators, they don't do that. They talk and then they end their phrase and they already know they do it phrase by phrase and sentence by sentence, which is great. That is a better way. That is a better technique in terms of communicating. So in terms of we can relate efficiency to this too. It's funny you say debate because there's this principle. I don't know where I heard this or who I was talking to, but my mind exploded when I heard it. And I thought that is the most devilish little thing I've ever heard. There is apparently a technique in debate where you intentionally say something wrong, and it just takes you, two sentences. You say something wrong, which just smears your opponent in some particular way or misrepresents his ideas, and then you go on. You keep making your case, and the idea of doing that is you say the thing that's wrong, so that the other person will latch onto that and spend half an hour talking about that and never get onto refuting the other points. So if I make a list, this is terrible. Wow. I wouldn't recommend it. It's just very clever. If I'm saying, oh, look, here's a list of 12 different points that I'm making. One of the points is wrong, and I've intentionally done it so that you'll get stuck on it. And you spend all of your time making one point. Mm-hmm. I've essentially made 11 points that you've not responded to. That's devilish. I mean, that's deceitful. That's terrible. But I would be a sucker for that because I would get sucked into that. Oh, I got to explain. And then before you know it, I'm out of time.
It really is robbing the other person of their ability to be efficient in that case. So it's very clever. And the reason I asked about debate in the last show, we talked about technique and we talked about technique showing up in a variety of places as the appearance of a kind of effortlessness. Right. And in efficiency, what we see is relaxation.
Yes.
Right. This is especially perceptible in debate, I think,
yes,
because we have definitely been, you and I'm sure this has been the case, where we're having maybe a heated conversation with somebody about a philosophical, economic, or political issue. They are hysterical. Mm-hmm. Maybe even resorting to ad hominem attacks. Mm-hmm. You maybe even gave an example of this in our first discussion. And we're calm. Mm-hmm. And that's a nice place to be, but I never want to be on the other side of that, right? Like I always want to be the calm one in that situation. But let's talk a little bit. Relaxation goes, it's important in debate and it's very easy to see in debate. The person who is winning the debate is usually the one who is much more relaxed. The other person is usually more like the opposite. Mm-hmm. But let's spread that out beyond just this activity of debate. Relaxation.
Yes. Yes. So this is, of all of the particular principles in understanding excellent technique, this is the one I'm sometimes most excited about because it's something, it's beneficial for people who are lazy. And what I mean by that, when you are, I'll give you, in jiu-jitsu is an excellent example. There are two main schools of jiu-jitsu. One's Japanese jiu-jitsu and the other is Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And I've studied both. I've studied Japanese jiu-jitsu more than I have Brazilian jiu-jitsu. In Japanese jiu-jitsu, there are techniques that you can learn. Some of them are wrist locks, for example, which I want to talk about a little bit more in some detail, that literally can only be applied with a physically relaxed body, as in your muscles have to be relaxed, not limp fish, but you can't be tense. And it took me probably 3 years, to be honest, of hearing this from my instructor over and over and over and be like, wow, I mean, no, that's not right. I mean, what is this tension? And then for whatever reason, I got it. And it was like, holy crap, this is so counterintuitive that you think like, oh, especially in the martial arts, it's about tension and muscle strength. That's not the case. It's about actual physical relaxation that you can use in a purely mechanical way to be more effective in your technique. This is also something you see in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. There are some techniques, though not perhaps not as many, that are literally only effective, that only work when your muscles are relaxed. My favorite technique in all of the martial arts is one in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. It's called the triangle. It's where you put one leg over somebody's shoulder, the other leg under somebody's arm, and then you can choke them out with a counter pressure. It's awesome. I like it a lot, one, because I have the body structure for it. So I'm a tall guy, which is really good for triangles. And it is outrageously effective. You can have somebody who's 5'2" put a 300-pound monster in a triangle choke, and if it's appropriately applied, it's a guaranteed choke out. A really interesting principle in jiu-jitsu in particular is that when you are efficient with your technique and your technique is precise, what you do is you find weaknesses in your opponent's body mechanics. This has been done over thousands of years in terms of finding where the structural weaknesses are. You find those weaknesses in the neck, for example, like your arteries are a weakness because it doesn't take much force to close them off, which knocks you out, it chokes you out. And you put your strong muscles, whether it's your arms, you get somebody in a rear naked choke, which is choking them out with your arms. You get them in a triangle, which is choking them out with your legs. You put your strong muscle against their weak part, and then it doesn't really matter the size differential because it doesn't take much force at all to get a maximally efficient result, which is choking somebody unconscious with your legs or with your arms or whatever it is. So that's something you see that comes up all the time in the martial arts, is this idea of physical relaxation. You gave the example last time of playing the guitar. Holy mackerel, is this a fantastic example. I also tried to teach myself guitar, but fortunately I had YouTube to do it. And what you find is the people that are playing objectively superior technique do not have a lot of tension. They're not playing like that. Or it's the same case with piano. Mm-hmm. Their actual physical muscles are relaxed, which is maximally efficient. They're eliminating all of the unnecessary movement to master the techniques. And in fact, a lot of times, what's really cool is if you listen to excellent performers or people are executing at a very high level, they even talk about efficiency. They'll even say things explicitly like, oh, you have to reduce this external, this unnecessary movement because it prevents you from playing faster. It means more tensions in your arm, which means you're more likely to get hurt. They say it explicitly, you know, and it's cool because most of these people don't do a breadth of stuff, and so they don't necessarily see that principle of relaxation is this kind of universal principle in all of these disciplines. I'll give one more example of two more examples in the world of ideas, and relaxation in the world of ideas. One, you can put on the chessboard. I would still say the chessboard is kind of the world of ideas. It's entirely mental. It's not about any of the physical phenomena that's taking place. So relaxation when you're playing a game of chess would be not freaking out. If you are intimidated by your opponent and you are tense, you're mentally or sometimes even physically tense because you don't want to lose and you don't want to look silly and all that, you're going to calculate incorrectly. You're going to do things inefficiently. You have a limited amount of battery in terms of mental calculation when you're playing chess that you go through. And if you are not efficiently managing that battery in terms of how much mental power you can put into your calculations on the chessboard, you're going to lose because you're going to run out of energy. I mean, that happens all the time. So you have to be relaxed. It's not that big a deal. You have to be mentally relaxed. And last, in the world of, and purely the world of ideas, go ahead.
Well, no, yeah, that's interesting. I'm just thinking about chess and my limited experience with it. If every time it's your turn to move, you're exerting, I guess it would translate to physical energy in the martial arts. You're you're wearing yourself down if you're not good very quickly. Like you're your own worst opponent.
Yes.
Because not knowing what to do, not having the proper technique, you are basically exerting a tremendous amount of thought and consideration at each turn.
Yes.
And it actually is exhausting in a way. Like I'm most exhausted at the end of the days where I exert myself mentally,
yeah.
you know, more than on days where I do it physically.
Oh, yeah. Chess will burn you out like you wouldn't believe. If you go on a chess marathon and you're trying to do all this calculation stuff, mm-hmm. it'll burn you out and your mind will be mush. And then it's especially frustrating, too, because sometimes you want to sleep. But if all you've done is just worked your brain all day, sometimes your body isn't ready to sleep. So you're in this terrible state of mush where you can't really fall asleep because your body isn't tired, but your mind's exhausted. I'll say, too, this is the most pronounced I have ever experienced in any discipline is in the martial arts, specifically Brazilian jiu-jitsu and grappling. Because I've been doing Brazilian jiu-jitsu for only 2 years now. So this is something I've been aware of and I've been a fan of for many, many years, but I haven't lived in a place where I've been able to train it. And I've been training for a few years and I absolutely love it. But I went into my training with a decade of martial arts experience.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty confident in being able to defend myself. You go in there, and I'm not a particularly big guy, but when you're actually, we call it rolling, we call sparring on the ground rolling. When you're rolling for like the first time, the first few months, you have never experienced such physical exhaustion. There is nothing like I have ever experienced which even comes close to the degree of physical exhaustion that you get when you're fighting. That's because it's kind of scary to have somebody on you who's, you know, maybe slapping you lightly in the face to let you know, hey, you got to defend yourself. Like, that's scary internally. You get your adrenaline going. But also physically, it moves. Your body has never moved that way if you've never moved that way. And you can be a long-distance marathon runner. You can be an Olympic weightlifter. I don't care. If you don't have prior experience specifically training, like in fight simulation, you will be burned out of energy in a minute. Minute tops with somebody that knows what they're doing, because you're going to freak out. Everybody does it. There's like a stereotypical thing that everybody does where somebody mounts you and they're on and you push up and you turn over, and there's like this set route, the techniques that everybody goes through when they don't know what they're doing, and it is absolutely exhausting, which is why my instructor up there says, and accurately so, that being able to defend yourself, once you understand the basics of how to defend yourself from basic punches and chokes and stuff like that, is really about energy. It's about whose battery gets drained first. Because for me, I mean, I'm 160 pounds. Yeah, I'm 6'4", so I'm a big guy. But if I'm up against some 6'8", 300 pound guy, I know if I cannot lose long enough where his energy level is depleted below mine, I can beat him. Guaranteed. And that's true not just for me, that's true for anybody. But it's not easy to get to the point, I'm certainly not there, to get to the point where you can hang on long enough to have the other person drain down their energy so that you can effectively do your techniques on them.
Indeed.
That dynamic is perfectly mimicked in the chess world. And it could be even in, we're talking about debate or in the world of ideas, where some people have explicit styles in chess where they throw these outrageously complex moves at you, knowing that they're not perfectly precise, but that the effort that is required to solve that puzzle is just so massive that your mental energy will be drained where you're going to make an error. And it's very effective. That's a very effective way of playing.
Yeah. Did you have one more example regarding relaxation, which is really a recurrent theme here in the philosophical realm? You had one ready and I cut in and I was interested that was.
Oh, no. I was just going to say it wasn't a specific example. It was just in the world of ideas in general. What does relaxation look like when you're talking about something like economics or you're talking something like in philosophy? Well, then it's not necessarily about physical relaxation. It is something about mental relaxation in terms of what your way of coming up with concepts. So, for example, the place where I do my best thinking is in the shower. I have like waterproof notebooks because I love writing in the shower. That's where I feel most mentally relaxed. I don't get stuck in these ruts that sometimes we get in. We put ourselves in kind of pre-framed boxes for how we think about issues.
Sure, yeah.
So being really mentally relaxed is being really open and not tense and thinking, well, maybe there's just this totally other way of resolving this philosophic problem in a way that I'm just not thinking of now. You got to be open to it. So that's what that would look like.
I gotcha. And beyond relaxation, another important part of efficiency is directness, right?
Yes. Getting from A to B linearly.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean by that is, debate's a good example, we can go back to that, is some people, when they are communicating, for whatever reason, they'll go very roundabout. It's almost like passive aggressiveness, right? When people are being very
sure.
Kind of, well, I'm not saying this. Well, you can't really pin me down for this because I'm not saying that directly. What I would say is objectively superior technique in terms of efficiency would be communicating directly. Because then if you communicate directly, one, you won't be ambiguous about what is the content of what is being communicated, which is the whole point of communication in the first place. But also it reduces the amount of time you need to talk with one another. And it increases the amount of time that you can devote to other things that you need to talk about, like in a relationship, for example. Direct communication, not necessarily aggressive communication, but direct communication is, I would say, very much preferential to indirect kind of weak communication. And this is the directness you see, again, very explicitly in the martial arts. Direct motion, right? If I'm going to throw a punch, I don't want to do this kind of looping arm punch, right? If I can do a straight punch, it's much more effective. You get your hips into it. You can generate a lot of power. There is certainly a place for something like a hook punch. Its directness is kind of in a different way. It's not linear getting to its path. Its directness would be maximizing that curved path.
You know, here's an interesting thing. When we talk about directness and we talk about people asserting conclusions. And one of the things that I've noticed, and I just want to get your thoughts on this, the people that I've dealt with that know the most, that have self-studied the most, show an incredible level of directness and commitment to their positions. But conversely, the people I've interacted with who've studied the least and know the least seem to show an equal amount of commitment, or I find myself somewhere in the middle. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yes.
That occurred to me, and I think that's really interesting because I and this is going to come up in one of our later discussions on embracing what you don't know. But
right.
I talk to people who are extremely bright, extremely well-read, and they are very direct and very, very committed, and they know how to basically take you from whatever statement you make or whatever question you asked exactly to their conclusion very, very quickly. But people who know the least seem to think that they can do the same thing, but they'll at least commit just as hard and just as fast to a certain conviction. What do you make of that?
That's an excellent insight. It's something I hadn't thought about, but yeah, I'm glad you bring it up because it would be an error to think that all efficient technique is correct technique. You can have relaxedness and still do things incompetently. So like if you have like your hand is relaxed, but you're playing the wrong notes on the fretboard, right? And you're not being precise, and you don't know what you're doing.
Right.
Doesn't mean you're doing guitar correctly. It just means you're being wrong in a relaxed way. You're exactly right in terms of the world of ideas. People think that maybe being direct and being relaxed is like stating ultimate conclusions. But when people who are competent state their conclusions in a direct way, it's with a bunch of other stuff behind it. They only get to the point of efficiency and directness based on all this other research and understanding that they have, versus people who, I know exactly who you're talking about, the people that state the conclusions rigorously and accurately, that's all that there is. It's just a conclusion. There's no reasoning behind it other than, I read this in the New York Times or whatever.
Yeah.
You see that all the time. Two more examples kind of illustrate. One, if anybody wants to go to YouTube and punch in like Roger Federer highlights, this is a great example. Not necessarily like just his shots, although his shots are maximally efficient. But if you watch like a game or two of Roger Federer, you'll see how efficient his movement is on the court. Another area that I was actually thinking before we did this that might be helpful is something like what you're doing right now with podcasting. That somebody might say, to do a podcast, like you just have to do these things and then you end up with a podcast. But it's like, no, there is an objectively superior and objectively, many objectively inferior ways to do a podcast and to do it inefficiently. So like one principle of efficiency in terms of podcasting or video production is what is the software that you're using to edit? If you have an hour long audio that you're trying to edit and you're going in and manually moving like every waveform for every word, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah. Right?
That's not an effective way of doing it. So what you need to do, just like before with trying to understand the correct theory before you start doing stuff, is try to find the right software. Try to think, what is the efficient way of doing this? Like if when you're trying to communicate with people and you're sending emails about like, hey, when are we going to do this interview? And your idea is, oh, well, I'm going to send these 3-page things talking about my life story, and then like we're going to send an attachment, like a picture of my kids and my dog, and like you're all over the place. And that has happened sometimes. People communicate that way on email sometimes. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not effective. That's not efficient. That's not a good way to build a reputation of, hey, look, this is somebody who's competent and knows what they're doing.
Yeah, I was actually concerned about that with these shows that I'm doing with you, because I like I said in the introduction, I'm much more of a learner in these conversations. So even though I have an outline, I don't ultimately know where they'll go. Where in the past, I've done a lot of shows where I feel like I have a very good grasp of the subject that we're talking about. It's familiar territory, and I can question by question or transition by transition make the discussion happen exactly how I want it to. And it's fine if I don't. It's exciting if I don't. Our last show was an hour and 15 minutes. This show will be a half an hour, you know? Right. But I think about podcasting more generally, one of the advantages I had, and some of the people that I've worked with have had in the last 6 or 7 years, is we started on a really tight budget. And because of that, we had to be very, very mindful of how we operated. So if we had, you know, I wouldn't know how to do anything. If I had a $10,000 a month operating budget, I could outsource all of the post-production work. I would have, a $1,000 or $2,000 piece of equipment that would capture all the video and make it very easy to, you know, sync audio and video and do live editing and all that stuff. So are there more efficient ways of doing what I'm doing? Sure. They cost a lot of money,
right?
But I have spent a lot of time experimenting, and I think that's produced a different kind of product. It might not be the most efficient way to do it. I couldn't put out a podcast every day. Right. You know, it's too much work to do it the way I currently do it, but I don't want a daily podcast. If I could make every podcast, we did a 4-hour show about James Bond and connections to British intelligence and like Cecil Rhodes Roundtable groups, kind of like a fun history adventure show at the end of last year. 4 hours long, lots of great post-production enhancements. If somebody came to me and said, there's a way you could do that every day, I would listen. I wouldn't believe them. But I would rather prioritize quality and following the mission of what we do over, you know, the frequency of output, being able to do something on a daily basis. That's secondary to me.
Yes, and there's a couple things there that are really good. One, you were just talking about the maximizing your effectiveness given the inputs of a certain financial constraint. I mean, that is the principle of efficiency to a T. But you can even take that and out of something like learning and something like money management for your household. You know, you can have an efficient money management strategy, which is like, don't spend a bunch of money on superfluous things if you don't have the money in the bank for that, versus if somebody is being inefficient, that's the wrong way of money management. If your goal is to, you know, build up a savings, there isn't objectively correct several objectively correct methods of doing that, and many, many, many incorrect ones. The other thing you said, though, was about podcasting, and it made me think, wouldn't it be a shame and a big confusing error to look at people who have successful podcasts and say, gosh, they can only do that because they're Brett. Mm. They can only do that because they're intrinsically special. It's like, no, you know that's not what's going on. You've got a great podcast, and it's not because you're a special snowflake and you're the only one that can do it. You may be a special snowflake, but just like everybody else is a special snowflake. If they understood the technique and the methods involved that you've discovered through the process of trial and error and failure, then they could also do it as well. There's no mysticism at play here at all.
They could create their own special snowflake podcast.
Exactly.
See, I don't know if anybody else could create the School Sucks podcast the way I did. They could create a different version of it that's just as good. They could create a different version of it that was better, but it wouldn't be my version of it. So yeah, you're right. There is, and I would make these checklists available to people. I talked about the production flow on a recent podcast, which was actually part of an effort to maximize efficiency, creating a step-by-step production flow. But yeah, I take your point. And that was always part of the appeal of this is like, hey, I'm an ordinary guy, and look, I'm doing a cool thing, and you can too. Even though I think most people in the audience already know they can too, and they do their own cool things, but I still like to make that explicit.
So I have one more concept that we have to have very clearly articulated, because it might seem counterintuitive, but you have to understand it. Inefficient technique, incorrect technique, can still result in good results. It's kind of what we talked about last time with the poker, but this is true for efficiency, specifically like in the martial arts. There are the majority of people who you're going to be rolling with, who are training with, have a really tense, unrelaxed technique. That's just the way it is in that world.
Right.
Now, sometimes there are particular dojos that like the place that I'm training now, there's a very high ratio of competent people, but that's why I chose that dojo, because they know what they're talking about. The majority of them out there are what they're called smashers. They're just tense. They're going to, you know, pin your back to the mat and try to just muscle you. That's the way it is. And the thing is, you have to understand that can still work. It's not objectively better technique, but it is still something that can get the job done. And so some people get confused and they think, oh, well, if you're getting good results, it must be that you have good technique. That's not the case. It's about doing things the right way so that you can overcome these kind of plateaus that these people will reach. You see this in chess. Some people, in fact, the other day I was playing a chess game. Somebody was playing something I knew was, I guess you could call inefficient, but was wrong. And he's a very high level player. And I thought, well, what's going on here? It's the phenomena you see all over the place, which is, people will have something, they'll do something wrong, but it works. And they know, like a poker player that plays wrong, but he knows he can win a lot of money from a lot of people. It's really hard sometimes to beat those guys. And I lost because it was his game. He'd already done it. He'd probably played the game 500 times. He knew those positions better than I did, so he got away with it. Or it would be like producing a podcast inefficiently, or like running your household inefficiently. Yeah, you can still do it, but we're talking doing it the right way, seeing that. You know, if you're doing something really grossly wrong with your podcast or your chess game or your martial arts game, you're going to reach a point at which you can't go any higher. You're going to top out. And that's what we're trying to overcome. They blast through those plateaus and think, okay, this technique, though right now I might be losing to the smashers, eventually I'm going to get beyond that and well beyond that.
Yeah, and there's emotional considerations for that too, right? You can kind of keep trucking along doing things the same way. I've tried that with certain things for long periods of time. But eventually, the fact that you're treading water, or the realization of the fact that you're treading water, that you're not making progress, it really produces a burnout, a drop in enthusiasm for something you used to be very, very enthusiastic about. So it can be really, really dangerous to settle for inefficiency.
Yes,
just
certainly.
Because you're ultimately getting to point B, you're not really trying to refine the process of how you get there from A.
Exactly. And like your example with the guitar is a great one, because for you, I don't know if where your guitar skills are now, but if you want to get to the point of mastering the guitar, not only are you going to have to start from square one, you're going to have to start behind that, because you have deliberately created habits in your how your physical body moves and how you play that you have to overcome, which is another obstacle, which is why it's so hard for people that have committed to an inefficient technique and they're getting, you know, 70% of where they could or maybe less. And, you know, they're treading water, as you say. It's so dang hard to be like, okay, I'm doing something wrong. I got to change one of the fundamentals, because then you got to unlearn everything that you've learned.
Right. Right. Absolutely. And that's what I said with the tunnel called skill is filled with dirt that I have to shovel out before I can even get started. So on the principle of efficiency, what is, in your mind, the most essential takeaway for the people listening?
The most essential takeaway is, again, just to be aware of it and to be aware of your own inefficiency. Part of the process, this is something we'll talk about later when we talk about incompetence, but part of the process of getting to objectively superior technique and getting to efficient technique is recognizing and being very aware of when something is inefficient. So if you're spending 8 hours editing one waveform and you could be doing another, you know, with some software that'll do it automatically, you have to be aware of that. If you're not aware of it, it's going to cause trouble. If in your golf swing, you know, there's some inefficiency, there's some pain, there's some, you know, something's really wrong, something really clunky, you have to be aware of it and don't just think, oh, well, that's the way it is. That's just the name of the game. It's like, no, that is a marker of inefficiency, which is a marker of incorrect technique. And if you're humble enough and you want to try to learn how to correct that, you got to seek out how to do that.
Right. Exactly. You know, I want to get into that a little bit more in our next couple of discussions, because I'm going to find examples, especially in the world of podcasting. There's all kinds of plugins and automations to make things go faster, but are they going to give me the product I want if I use them instead of doing what I see as a more delicate kind of brushing or chipping away by hand type process that takes more time but gives me a different result?
That, and that's an excellent point, though, because there is a dynamic between it's, the ultimate goal is not efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
The ultimate goal is getting from A to B. You want to get to B. So if the B is the producing a high quality podcast, then you shouldn't sacrifice B just because you want to do it more efficiently.
Absolutely.
Right? That puts the cart before the horse.
Absolutely. Well said. I'm glad we touched on that. So thanks again, Steve, and you'll be back soon to talk about mastering the basics.
Thanks, Brett. My pleasure.
Let me tell you about German chocolate cake. Oh boy, today's new subscriber is David B, and he is from Dallas, Texas. Wait till you hear about this place. Dallas, among other things, is known for musicians with edible names like Meatloaf and Vanilla Ice. But food facts don't stop there. Let me tell you about German chocolate cake. Now you're probably thinking, that's from Germany, right? No, it was actually developed in Dallas, Texas by an American named Sam German. Oh, that explains it. The dessert was popularized after his recipe appeared in a 1957 edition of the Dallas Morning Star. Holy shit. Now, of course, we all know that Dallas is quite the sports city with teams like the Cowboys and the Mavericks. But a thing that Dallas is not so well known for is originally giving its sports teams really stupid names. Did you know the Cowboys were originally called the Steers? The name was changed quickly, however, when the team's general manager decided he didn't want a castrated mascot. Dallas's first baseball team was called the Hams, a stupid baseball team name outdone possibly only by nearby Houston's first franchise. They named their team the Babies. But just because Dallas hasn't been able to nail sports team names on the first try, that doesn't mean that the city doesn't have an impressive list of notable firsts. The nation's first convenience stores, now known as 7-Eleven, started here in 1922. The first car radio was developed by Henry Garrett in the early 1920s. The first drive-up bank window appeared in 1938 at Hillcrest State Bank. Now at that point, you're probably thinking that the people of Dallas patted themselves on the back and then threw up their hands and said, "That's it. This drive-up window thing is the pinnacle of time-sensitive banking technology progress." And well deserved if they did, but they didn't. Listen to this. Just over two decades later, the idea for the ATM machine was developed in Dallas, Texas. And the frozen margarita machine was developed by Dallas restaurateur Mariano Martinez in 1971, just 4 years after the birth of Vanilla Ice. New subscriber geography trivia.